Hello, welcome to Diving Into the Wreckage and the Train Wreck Arrives. We have been gone for almost 6 months. We're now, 95 days into Trump's new regime. Last time we talked was, I think the night after the election.
You and me and while. Andy.
I had a cancer scare. You had a stroke.
Yeah. Yeah, for listeners of Antifada, they know what happened. But for Diving Into the Wreckage, for Farm Vlog people, yeah, I had a terrible brain injury. Complications from minor surgery set me back a bit. But just a couple weeks ago, I got a clean bill of health. So let's go. Let's do it. First 100 days, I think that goes back to FDR, right? And the flurry of executive orders and legislation that was passed in 1933 in the midst of the Great Depression. And ever since then, the first 100 days has come to represent for political scientists and pundits or whatever, this sort of, this normalized notion that in the first 100 days, a new presidency, a new administration really sets the tenor and the tone for the next 4 years. And Trump has not yet even finished his first 100 days. And I think it's very safe to say, as you say in the title of this, that the train wreck has arrived. The train has pulled into the station. It's pulled into Finland Station, which it turns out there's nobody at Finland Station anymore. It's just like a parking garage, basically. And here we are now. We're standing. History is happening. Things are happening. And we're just kind of bystanders here. We're just kind of trying to take it all in and trying to think about our priors, trying to think about structure, trying to think about contingency, trying to think and look at the things we know or thought we knew about the world and how that our theory and our imagination might match this moment, as tough as that is.
Right.
Boy, are we in the shit right now. Well, how are you feeling?
Yeah. I mean, I'm anxious as much as anyone else, although I will also say I'm not here to put an opportunistic sense of optimism because of crisis generating optimism. I actually find those kinds of ways of thinking to be, frankly, bullshit and something that carnival barkers do. But nonetheless, I do think we have to be somewhat objective in realizing that once your priors are out the window, and even if you can talk about the long durée things that led up to this, and we can, in some ways, FDR is the beginning of a shift towards what we see today. I pull from the philosopher Michael Sandel. He's a kind of left communitarian philosopher. And I pull from some thinkings on republics. And since we haven't had new constitutions like France, we don't refer to the American as multiple republics, but I think we've had at least four.
You're talking the antebellum period. Then you're talking about, I don't know, maybe the 18, certainly the post Civil War period to the Gilded Age or to Woodrow Wilson. And then what, the 1930s onwards, or would you put a fourth one, maybe 1960s onward? I don't know what periodizing would be.
I would say your periods go from the following. Early Republic to the Civil War, which is kind of a small Republican tradition, natural aristocrats on one end, but also obsession with actually representing local constituencies on the other. There's no idea of really national popularity in any coherent sense, because it wouldn't make sense in communication styles and whatnot anyway. Even the printing press couldn't hold a polity as big as ours, even back then. Together, then you have, which is also a period of expansion.
It's a period of expansion, and it's also a period where the social forces, the economic forces that would ultimately undermine those tendencies you're talking about are arising, Obviously, I mean the first industrial revolution in the United States.
Then there's the post Civil War, which also happens to have to coincide with the Industrial Revolution, which is a big deal, to 1910, where the state is integrating more with capital, but the state is still very small. You're still mostly dealing with the state integrations at the local level. You also have a sense of national identity that just was not there before.
Yeah.
You have the frontier is still expanding, but it's beginning to close off. So you're looking at a different kind of imperialism emerging.
You have the railway acts, which are kind of giving like an early indication of like not just a national economy, which is important, but also like a nationally bounded like economic rule of law that is a national one. Of course, that wouldn't be realized until like the 1920s, 1930s, 1940s. But like the first implications of that are arising around this time.
Right. I mean, we start building a coherent currency, a singular currency during that time period. Like, there's a lot.
The Federal Reserve, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Then you have the interwar period, which is a shift to a couple things. One, old republicanism, which was even maintained during the second period that we're talking about of the early American Republic, where you have the consolidated national identity, you still had relatively homogeneous electorates. Mm-hmm. So like, even though you had a really diverse country, people lived in, with the exception of the South, people lived in clusters in a way that you could actually represent a constituency that was still relatively unified. Mm-hmm. You know, even if you had a bunch of German immigrants, that might be all you had. And so right.
Or you represented like a single congressional district of Yorkville on the Upper East Side, which is just all German Catholics.
Right.
or the Five Points, like all Irish Catholics.
So two things change in the early 20th century is like even the kind of small scale polities that, you know, federate up become more and more diverse. And you have a more and more diverse sense of capitalism, but with state regulation playing a bigger and important role, even if it is not, in the United States at least, a very top-heavy operation. Also, you have state investment mattering more and more. And that begins, like, you know, this is thing in Marxism where, like, even when we're still talking about capitalism writ large, and we still are, all these are either early capitalist or capitalist societies. I'm not saying that they're not, but you can see the shifts already in prior forms. So the railway regulation is what's going to lay the foundation for the post-war economies.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and the consolidation of the nation into one polity with the civil war amendments to the Constitution, which actually means that the Bill of Rights applies all the way down, not just the federal government. And I don't think most Americans know this. Like, you don't understand the differences in the Republic because we did not reset our Constitution. We either passed amendments that completely changed all the arrangements, even though from hindsight that doesn't look to be true, or like, we just kind of ad hoc'd it, which is increasingly what we did in the 20th century.
Which is interesting to understand this moment. One thing that I would say before I forget it is, like, it'd be interesting to revisit a history or like recraft a history like this, but based upon tariff regimes. Because like, this was something that we thought we left behind in like the 19th and early 20th century. But maybe there is like a periodization with tariffs coming back as like a return of the American system or something like that. But it is true. We don't have a first, second, third republic. We have like a series of ad hoc arrangements, except, of course, we've got the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment, right? And then we've got a series of amendments in the 20th century. But it's the ad hoc nature of, say, like, I'm not sure where you're going with your last most recent period. Maybe it's the 1960s. Is that where you're periodizing?
No, like, I actually think you have a breakdown in the 1960s and you have another breakdown after 9/11.
Oh, so a fifth republic after 9/11.
Yeah, we're basically at a fifth republic. And
ooh, that's interesting. I like that. Okay.
And by that, I also mean that, like, because I haven't gotten to what I think is interesting about this time period. The state from FDR through Eisenhower into the Kennedy administration was a state legitimized by policy.
Mm.
Like, it had narratives. People still had grand narratives, American exceptionalism, blah, blah, blah. But what they were actually doing, like, if you look at the difference between FDR and Truman and Eisenhower, those are distinctions in policy and in management. But they're not even huge distinctions. There's a relatively constrained consensus there. In the 60s, that starts to break down, which also means that period that we base most assumptions on about how American politics works is like the late 40s to the 50s, which is a remarkably brief period of time. And yet, because it's when the baby boomers are born, and because that is the world that, that creates the infrastructure that they grow up in, that is normalized as a, the American experience.
And all, yeah, I think that there's something very profound about that. I think that the assassination of Kennedy, right, at a formative period for the baby boomers, signals like a break from the normalcy that they imagined or even lived through as young right. people, right?
Right. And they and the war was so traumatic that in some ways it blacked out all memory of anything before that wasn't mythic, like the mythic Western expansion narratives that were served such an ideological and entertainment purpose in the 1950s and 60s, early 60s. Now, I think we on the left tend to underestimate that 9/11 was a big shift because it completely changes us towards more of a security state. And that actually does affect the way we organize the economy. And it's subtle. But one of the things that you start noticing is increasingly, and we see this in Europe, but we don't see this so much in the United States, except during World War II, we start justifying all public policy from competence into crisis. So no one's trying to actually justify things by what they can do. They're justifying it because that's also the shift in the pure negative partisanship. And these things are overdetermined in the classical sense. I don't just mean this in the Althusserian sense. There's so many inputs going into them. You can't see one line of causality. There's no one singular cause. So you can't actually articulate it until it happens. But these kinds of complex interactions create black swan moments. So, for example, the tariff regime. You're talking about tariffs. Like, I don't think we're returning to McKinley tariffs. I think this is largely going to fail because
it's being done so poorly. Yeah, we're seeing it in the process of its failing. We might end up getting 10% across the board tariffs. These reciprocal tariffs that were put out just seem designed to almost delegitimize the whole conception of tariffs in a tariff regime. They're so ad hoc and weird. But we're getting a trade war with China. So that is something. Maybe that's mission accomplished. Maybe that is probably what large swaths of the American ruling class wanted to do anyways. So, yeah.
Well, I mean, so we have to ask ourselves now that we live in this conception. The other thing that I want to say, though, is all this America stuff makes it seem like it's America-centric. The tendency towards different kinds of Bonapartisms, and by that, I mean a tendency towards a more and more unitary executive, even though you still have a legislative thing that is tied into either subtle expansions of power and territory, such as, trade leverage and neocolonialism, or explicit expansion of territory and leverage, such as in the early 20th century, where you have not neocolonialism, outright colonialism, etc. This is not unique to now, but it makes sense to happen actually in a declining, when there's no clear singular hegemon. And we and our enemies, including like the Project 2025 people and this and that, have been assuming priors stay consistent, even though they're changing all the other inputs. So the Mar-a-Lago Accords are the plan that was half cocked up by one of Trump's junior members about the tariffs, which was to induce a recession to lower
borrowing
costs and dollar values. But it was based off the idea that people would not abandon treasury bonds.
Yeah. Despite the chaos ensuing. Right.
It was based off the idea that priors that existed under non-chaotic times would continue. And this is why Trump's policies have tended to overestimate American power. Not because America isn't powerful, but because it was based on a set of priors that he wants to erase. And right. this is why I said that I didn't take, this was my prior. I was assuming that the powers that be, even though that they were isolated and rational, knew the danger of this kind of thinking. Because when I did read Project 2025, and I was like, no one can be serious about this because it's incoherent. You can't neoliberalize an economy internally and also think you're going to build back up industrial capacity with no government investment.
Right.
And very few tax incentives even.
Yeah.
You definitely can't do it while you're destabilizing everything and deleveraging the federal government. I was just like, nobody could believe that. Well, I was wrong. They can't believe it. It's just wrong.
Like, I know. It's wrong, and it's kind of crazy. Like, there's this weird tension at play, which is like, you know, if you imagine what Trump and company claim they want to do, it could perhaps be some synthesis of like Trump and Biden, because like I'm interested, always interested in pointing to the continuity of these things. And I think you are too, at least the continuity of the processes happening below that both Democratic and Republican administrations and politicians are responding to, and various different stakeholders within that. Right. But you can imagine some sort of synthesis of like Trumpism and Bidenism, where you have a strong state-centric industrial policy, which like subsidizes core key industries in order to make up for the clear deficits in manufacturing, say pharmaceuticals or masks or ventilators or tanks or steel, or all these things we've seen over the last 5 years that American industrial capacity just is unable to do in the private sector. It's possible to imagine that combined with some sort of tariff regime, right? But it's impossible imagining even a change like that happening from within the Biden administration or from within a Trump administration constrained by the Republican Party, because in order to break out of a sort of like neoliberal consensus oriented sort of, consensual embedded political process of political power and accumulation of capital and global hegemony and a dying unipolar moment, in order to break out of that, in order to have the juice to even like push through a massive change like this, you kind of have to smash the whole thing up. And that's like why I'm relatively bloodless about what's happening under Trump in the first 100 days. It's not because I think these things are unimportant, but I understand that there's like a blockage. There's been a blockage for many years, for at least 15 years now, within the political system, which is now expressing itself in these insanities, in these inanities, in these absurd moments of contradictory movements of politics in the economy that I think like was impossible for political reasons for either of the parties to push through. And I think that Biden is an expression of that, that I think that Donald Trump, exactly because he's an amateur, because he's not a politician, because he's like a smash him up creative destruction businessman, is the only person capable of making the leap into the darkness necessary to do this. But it's also like impossible because of his temperament to do it correctly. So we're in this weird position right now where something had to break the system, but like that meant necessarily that nothing, that it could not be broken in such a way that was like manageable. It had to be a chaotic breakup. And that's what we're living through right now.
But I don't think people grasp what that means, because I think leftists right now, if I see like Vivek Chibber going on Doom Scroll talking about the left that blames the working class, as if he's talking about the new left or even the left of the 1990s and aughts, that left is gone. And yes, there's a,
yeah,
that left is gone. When Bernie Sanders dies and is replaced by his successor AOC, that's a more profound moment than people realize, because AOC is not Bernie Sanders. And both of this, I do want to sound a little bit of cynicism here, because there's a lot of people who've gotten really excited as if they've forgotten the last 4 years.
I can't believe we're doing this again, but go on, please.
Right.
I share your cynicism.
Because it's erasing the fact that they were not smart actors in terms of leverage during the Biden administration. They just weren't. But the rest of the Democrats are still pretending that this is fuck 1992, maybe 2007. Like, I mean, bringing out James Carville, who has not helped the Dems win an election since the Clinton administration, and who has given actively bad advice to many candidates, and seeing, you know, a Cuomo on the news, like, try to antagonize him into suing David Hogg, tells you where we're at. That like, there's these people, they're not just coasting on fumes. They were coasting on fumes at the end of the Bush administration, and they've had 20 more years.
And this is what's so maddening about watching this mop-up operation by Sanders and AOC, trying to put Humpty Dumpty back together again, try to get like the grassroots Democratic party, which is primarily working class, middle class people, you know, trying to get them out to rallies to try to solidify this base again and put its imprimatur on things. This is like, as you said, the last 15 years from, and I'll go all the way back to Obama, have been like a deep and fundamental failure of the Democratic Party to live up to even its own self-professed goals. And that said, people on the left.
That's not even dealing with the amount of goals we projected onto them that they didn't profess.
Or that certain, that enough segments within were willing to pay lip service to, that one on the left could plausibly believe it from like Obama on forward, that Obama was going to be FDR part two, that like, well, he would have bailed out the homeowners, but he didn't have the votes for it, or like passing the card check, right, was just too difficult with the Democratic Senate that they had at the time. There are people willing to, people on the left willing to give the Democrats a pass for the last 15 years or so. But to watch this happen again now, after, as you said, this incredible failure on so many fronts to use real leverage within the Biden administration to get something, anything done, I think it shows not just the bankruptcy of the Democratic Party, but the bankruptcy of the left, being unable to see this moment as a moment where something different might arise, where our relationship to the Democratic Party might need to fundamentally change. And that power, maybe as it exists right now on the progressive left, isn't a power that we should even want, if we could even get it, right? We shouldn't want to be part of this power structure.
If you wanted to trade the change the Democrats, you'd have had to been building systems outside of the Democrats for 20 to 30 years before that ever happened, which is, by the way, what the conservatives really did do. There is a long durée process that no one foresaw Trump in 1960, right? But there is a Trump to Goldwater to blah, blah, blah. And these coalitions are constantly shifting, as is ours. And I'll get to some weird ones that are going to, that are happening. And I don't know how we should respond to them either. Like, it's not clear to me that we should just reject them to court, but we shouldn't trust these people entirely either. I'll get to it in a second, but to bring it up, like, MAGA has an imaginary idea of the economy, but so do the Democrats.
Yes. Yeah. And like, they both have similar reference points, which is the 1950s and the 1990s, which are both seen like comparatively as prosperous times that we would want to go back to. It depends upon like the valence of the discussion at hand, whether you want the 1950s or the 1990s.
Although I would say you're missing something about Trump, too. He also, for some reason, likes 1910s, which I don't really understand.
Nobody understands it. Who was the fucking Iago in his ear whispering to like him about McKinley? Because I know he didn't come up with McKinley reading a fucking book. I know, and he didn't like, come up with that sweet
a president so unstable that he was replaced by the first progressive imperialist Teddy Roosevelt and was killed. And then you want to implement, I'm not like, I know I'm going to sound like I'm coming down on Sean Fain, because a lot of the unions talk on tariffs are also not been great. But I get some of Sean Fain's points once he nuanced them. Although coming out wearing a Ross Perot's right shirt was like, it's just like, what are you? I remember that. Do you know?
I remember that. He was an oil man from Texas. You know, one of the most reactionary social bases ever to come out of world history.
Well, I also wanted to like point out that Sean Fain's narrative about when deindustrialization happened is false because it isn't NAFTA. Deindustrialization was done before NAFTA really even happened.
Oh, you want to open up the Reagan Revolution conversation? Because I'm fucking ready for it. I think people want some people on the right want this to be a Reagan Revolution. And if you look at this deindustrialization process, as you said, it begins with the like the leverage buyouts, the consolidations of the 1980s, and was really like a full frontal attack on our industrial capacity. Somehow. And again, this gets back to, like, let's say the antinomies between Trumpism and Bidenism, or like their deep implication with one another. It's like there is this conception, and Andy and I were talking about this on a recent episode, that the private sector is prepared to come and restart this reindustrialization, renationalization, reshoring process. But like we saw in the 1980s, what happens when you deregulate and you let the animal spirits back in the room and you say greed is good again, you get Gordon Gekko, right? You get financialization. You get like the turning of GM into GMAC and outsourcing. And, you know, it's not to say that there aren't going to be some jobs created. It's just I don't see where these people think the private sector is going to. As we've talked about many times on Diving Into the Wreckage, not only is producing things industrially a pain in the fucking ass, something every capitalist would much rather not create any goods or commodities at all, right? It's much better to take M and just turn it directly into M prime if you can get away with it. But of course, too, like the rate of profit on industrial commodities is extremely, extremely low. And so Biden's big push was to put fucking hundreds of billions of dollars into it to try to switch that around. Trump's is simply, it seems like, a return to a sort of Reagan conception that the broader society, civil society, bourgeois society, capital markets, industrialists, wherever the fuck they are going to come rushing to the gates to try to create some manufacturing renaissance of this country that was somehow stymied by what? By regulation, I guess. Not like some actual inherent tendencies within capitalism, not a declining rate of profit on industrial production, not the annoyance of having to even deal with factory production and wage labor to begin with, but instead government regulation. So there's a voodoo aspect of this too, right? Voodoo aspect going back to the 1980s and the Reagan Revolution, which really didn't work back then, and there's no reason to believe that it would work today.
Well, yeah, trying pre-Keynesian protectionism while also trying to do a Reagan Revolution simultaneously. I mean, you want to talk about contradictory impulses, but it is. But it also is like, for example, we've been talking about the end of neoconservatism, but what's happened with neoconservatism, and this is one of the things with Weird Allies, has split. You have neoconservatives like Marco Rubio who become, they like the unitary executive. That's what they've always wanted.
Yeah.
But then you have neoconservatives like Bill Kristol. It's like, but the unitary executive was for something. And you're not doing that thing. Fuck it. I'll side with Bernie Sanders. Which is crazy.
Yeah.
But also, like, it is not, if like, it's one of those things where our priors are having us miss that there were different reasons why different people were attracted to these political ideologies in the first place. And some people believe parts of it sincerely that they shouldn't have. Right? Like, but now that they've seen that they were wrong, there you see all kinds of shifts. And I don't know what we're going to do. That you were talking about how the resistance is dead. The resistance is coming back, but we don't know what it looks like.
Resistance had to think about itself this time, which is interesting, right? That's why when it does come back, and I agree that it necessarily has to, there's a lot of people saying, oh, the Democratic Party's a dead letter. It's like, I remember people saying that about the fucking Republicans in 2008, okay? And they thought about it for a while. Their resistance stopped for a little bit, and then the Tea Party gave them new life, and they were back, baby, and now we have Donald Trump. So, like, let's not expect that the resistance is dead forever. But it is interesting that the resistance had to recalibrate, had to test the wind first, unlike last time where it was, like, at the gates defending something that was strong, it felt like, something foundational, something that they could sink their teeth into. Now it doesn't even feel like their old priors hold up in such a way that they can like automatically resist.
No, I mean, one of the things I'll tell you that's really fascinating, we're still like on the left, we're still fighting woke versus anti-woke because most of us come out of the academy. That's why we're doing that. But I've been listening to the opposition's talking points. They're not really woke talking points. They're not trying to save DEI. They're just saying that they're using an attack on DEI to go after the civil rights legislation and stuff, which is true. So the, like, believe it or not, even though no one's doing a mea culpa, a lot of the, you know, older people in the room or even our people our age are just going like, well, that was dumb. But they're not saying that they thought that was dumb. So the left doesn't recognize it. I mean, some of them are, like James Carville is. He wants to kick all the progressives out. But even the progressives have changed their, like, people aren't talking about privilege. You do see people talking about white supremacy, but unless they're black, they seem like dinosaurs. And it's like, there's a lot more Hitler references and fascism references, and I'm not sure how helpful or unhelpful that is. And I think it's just bizarre that we're spending so much time arguing over these categories. I was going to bring out one of my frustrations with talking about the left. Sam Badger wrote a thing about this. Leftists talk about the left so much as if we know what the fucking is anymore. We don't. Like, it's an empty category in some ways. So the more we obsess over it, the more we're like projecting things upon it. Like, do we mean the DSA? Do we mean David Hogg? I mean, David Hogg's leading more primaries against Democrats than the DSA is.
Right.
Like, yeah. Do we mean
American Communist Party?
Yeah, the ACP.
Do we mean the historical what are they called? The Kleiman Group, right? The Marxist Humanist Initiative.
Like, it seems like all these groups have become like we're in a period of sex again, and on the far left. But the sects are completely unrecognizable to even like a few years ago.
Yeah.
And the sects are, there's sects that are viral in that like tradcasts, you meet all these like Zoomer tradcasts who are uncatchment, meaning they're not Catholic. They don't participate in Catholic social bodies. So it is purely a performative act. You see people who are highly under-socialized and frankly can barely talk when spoken to, not with the electronic medium between them. I'm not really exaggerating that much.
No, I know. I've ran into that, man, recently on the job, like a new engineer who's arrived, who's like 23 years old. And I really wanted him to be like normal, but he just can't be normal. And anyways, I know what you're saying. Go on.
But please. Why would you suspect them to be normal?
I don't know. I this is Pryor's like all the way down. Like you and I grew up in a world that is dead and dying, like whether we want to accept it or not. I always thought that society, social institutions, sociality was doing this work behind the scenes of like creating and recreating us as individuals and as people and as a society that wasn't necessarily good, but it was like,
but it was there,
real. It was there and it existed. And I'm not so sure about that anymore. And that's something beyond my ability. It was something that was maybe beyond my ability to theorize or understand, even recognize up until 5 years ago or so, but now has me horrified in a way that I don't think I've been horrified since I don't know when.
Well, a lot of your audience gets mad at how hard I come at communization, but this is one of my points against them, is you guys assume that crisis was a socializing factor.
Yeah.
Why? Like, yes, people.
Because it had been in the past, right?
Right. Because you hadn't outsourced all that socialization to technology. So you had to come together. But now you've done that. Now that exists. You have like. The centralization of society continued, but without people. People fragmented, but the technology centralized. And that was not something anybody really predicted as possible, except for maybe the Technocracy Inc. in the 30s. You know,
Elon Musk's grandfather.
Right. Those weirdos. But for the most part, even Marxists did not consider that as a possibility, that you could fragment the social order, but maintain centralization by technology filling in the gaps, which also means you have more and more cascade failures. For example, A lot of these people, if their AI goes down, not, or they don't have their phone, they have a panic attack. Why? They don't know how to do things without it.
Yeah, yeah.
It would be like me blinding you.
Right.
But you and I grew up in an analog world. We are, in some ways, dinosaurs.
We are dinosaurs, yeah. In a very real sense. You know, I'm... I go back to what's his face that wrote Mute Compulsion. The idea of us,
yeah,
the idea that like human beings have these tools which are these like extensions of ourselves, and so there's a way in which like a hammer, you know, is very similar to an iPhone in that like what's necessary in order to reproduce our labor necessarily exists as like an organ outside of ourselves, which must necessarily be social. I agree. I don't think that I was prepared to theorize, or I didn't even think it was possible for that technology to like intercede between people in such a way, not to change the way that people necessarily act as individuals, but instead to block the interaction between individuals that makes up a society outside of the workplace. I didn't think that was possible, but now we're living through that. And that's like a reality that people your age and my age maybe need to recognize, but it's a reality that so many people who are younger than us live in already. And it's one that the boomers, the people older than us, have just kind of tuned out. Like they have their iPad set to Newsmax or whatever, or MSNBC, and they're perfectly content to just while away their time until they pass from this world as it kind of engulfs in flames around us. If I sound bitter right now, it's because I kind of am. I'm a little embittered, I must say. Not embittered at anybody in general, but embittered at what's been going on.
Well, and this is why we don't have a, you know, brunch is over, but now we have no idea what it means. Because the first time, if we are honest, there were hints that things were changing earlier on. Like Occupy was about economics, not foreign policy for once. Gaza, in some ways, was a return to like the 90s and aughts kinds of protests, that, but with a different category of people who didn't go through that time period. I mean, and that's why even the generational expectations, I've been hearing like from 2022 to 2023, I heard millennial leftists talk about how the Zoomers were going to save us based off of like stuff like the Gaza protests. And I was like, you don't understand that generation. And I don't think we can even generalize. It's been fractaled. You don't see the reactionaries, and you're not seeing what's happening to men because you've bracketed out cishet men from the discussion for so long. And I know that that is like, this is one of the things where people are like, oh, you know, you're trying to erase. No, I'm not trying to erase other struggles, but this gets us into another problem that you have with the left. You have a left right now that is okay with like some pretty fucked up foreign policy stuff. This is what I think some of the neocons might even be cynically taking advantage of, to be quite honest. That once you stop impoverishment of people in their own country, which makes total fucking sense. And you have a left that goes, well, the empire's fucked up, but they're also like, and the people here deserve it. Which the first part is absolutely true. The second part is like, well, you can't build a politics off of like self-hate. That's not going to work. You have to have a way in which people can benefit and deleverage, at least relative to
as much as people have been trying to make that politics work since at least like what the night, like 1970 or something. Right.
Right.
Yeah. Go on. I have a link to the History Wars thing in here. We'll get to it at some point, but go on.
Right. So I think all this is actually very, very crucial because we're in a multipolar moment. We've all known this was coming. It didn't take that concept being popular on the left. Although people on the left thought it had moral content, it doesn't have. There are multiple multipolar worlds. There's stable ones and unstable ones. There's one with good feedback loops and bad feedback loops. There's capitalist and post-capitalist ones, et cetera, et cetera.
1914 was a multipolar world, as we know.
Right. As was 1890. People like, oh, that's not what we mean. And I'm like, yeah, but you're projecting what you mean onto it. It's just a neutral framework. Like, the realists aren't wrong about that.
No, and the realists are some very interesting people to listen to right now. as an important, I think, part of the Trump coalition, there may be some of the most reasonable ones, right? The realists when it comes to geopolitics and foreign policy. But it's very easy to forget that they have their own priors, and their priors are fundamentally different from, at least mine anyways, understanding this system of nation states and great powers as like reaching towards some sort of stability, right, within itself, under almost personifying the nation state itself, understanding power as like embedded in these national institutions, and nationalism being naturalized. All of these things, right, make them fundamentally anathema. But like, these are the voices from within. I feel like the MAGA coalition and part of what's happening in Europe too, that are trying to make sense of, I think, this multipolar moment in a way that's at least different from the neoconservatives of Marco Rubio or Barack Obama or whatever. And we can learn a decent amount from them without becoming them.
Right. Well, I mean, the thing is, though, that the smarter realist, one, I'm going to hype this up a little bit. There are different kinds of realists. Peter Zion is a Democratic Party realist. Right. Waltz actually doesn't agree with Mearsheimer on everything. E.H. Carr was a borderline, was a Marxist, and I don't know if he died a Marxist or was just Marxian by the time he died. But he was a realist. But Morgenthau, who's the other person who came up with this whole polarity framework in the first place, it was E.H. Carr and Morgenthau. Morgenthau was a profoundly conservative Cold Warrior. Mm-hmm. Like, these people, I mean, Mearsheimer, Kissinger, and Zeev Brzezinski are all realists, and they're all aggressive realists, even. Mm-hmm. Like, because there's defensive realists and aggressive realists. All those three people, they oppose each other, but they were all different kinds of aggressive realists. So we should be very careful when we like use these categories like this. But I agree with you. Like, the anti-war, the kind of realist anti-war apparatus of some of these people, and you still see it in Trump. For all of Trump's, like, we're going to nuke Iran to the sky, as soon as he got Iran to the negotiating table, as long as he's the one that got them to the negotiating table, he's willing to give a ton of stuff. Now, the problem that you have with Trump, and, for example, this has shown up in the way he's handled the his battles with the Ivy League, is that Colombia conceded, and then he didn't keep his promise immediately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. he'll do that. He's a very changeable man.
Right. But that means that other actors are going to put up more of a resistance because of there is no goal. There's like no benefit to capitulating.
Right. You don't have an honest broker as a negotiation partner.
Right. And we've already seen this too with Doge and the way that they've handled like layoffs, which they keep on getting undone, but they're going to eventually happen. Like, although there's so many different departmental laws and so many different statutes that regulate this. And like the Uber impoundment of the first 2 weeks of Doge is not happening anymore, except in agencies where they can get away with it. Mm. But we're seeing a fragmented federal government fragment apart. To bring it all the way back to the beginning before we get into behind the paywall stuff, but this is important. What leads to Trump actually does start with FDR. Mm-hmm. Tariffs or tax policy? Who should have that under the Constitution?
Congress, of course. Congress. A tariff is a tax, right? Essentially. Right. So is the
purview. Smoot-Hawley, for example, it was passed by Congress. It was not passed by a president. So it wasn't really, like, even though it was part of McKinley's policies and Herbert Hoover's policies, et cetera, it was not passed by them as individual people. So what has happened to the executive? It starts in World War II. We started needing a more responsive tariff regime that could respond quick enough to deal with the situation. And one of the things that I was pushing on Sean Fain or like NAFTA, I'm like, tariffs were low during NAFTA too. Though we have not had historically high tariffs since the New Deal. The New Deal set true reciprocal tariffs, and the result of setting reciprocal tariffs is tariff tended downwards on both sides. So there were tariffs.
Yeah.
There were tariffs, but they tended to be reciprocal. It was only in the 1970s when they became so low on the US end. And that was to make the dollar an international reserve currency. That's what that was for.
Part of the Nixon shock.
Right. Right. You know, it was not to like it. What? Yeah, they wanted to weaken labor, but they already could do that. And a lot of things changed during Nixon. I mean, one of the things that we have to look at, that's also the beginning of public sector unions, which have been holding unions together for forever. It's under Nixon from wildcat strikes.
Yes. It was postal workers especially. Yeah.
Right.
Something that FDR himself, of course, famously rejected the idea that public sector unions can bargain with the public, right? This was like the small R Republican argument against it.
Right.
Right. So under Nixon, you have like a financial refounding, which we've lived under for the last 55 years or so.
Right.
And tariffs are part of it.
Tariffs are part of it. But also, like, a lot of things that fucked workers in NAFTA weren't tariffs. It was other parts of the deal, like the ability to remove on both sides of the border, other protections for workers, et cetera, et cetera. So NAFTA was disastrous for American and Mexican. It wasn't as disastrous for Canadian workers. That's actually an interesting thing. Canada actually probably did benefit from it. But
it was like a great famine for Mexican workers. I mean, if you think about the migration patterns, it's very similar to like what you saw with the Irish Great Famine. You saw like large swaths of the Mexican previously protected peasants basically being proletarianized, and like 15 to 20% of their working class moving to the United States in order to try to find work. Like, think about that, the scale of that movement of people. And what that means for economies on both sides of that border. I mean, that was maybe one of the most profound shifts under NAFTA.
Right. I mean, that's when right nationalism starts to come back. And at first it starts in California, believe it or not. And that has to do with NAFTA. It also led to backlash, and this will too. A backlash in the way that helps the liberals. I mean, so, you know, it's weird, though, because if you do, like, when does protectionism and high tariffs work? When you're trying to do state investment and protect industrial capacity at the early stages of building up an industry.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It does work there. There's no evidence it works at any other time, though. Mm-hmm. Because you need more and more inputs that you can't get within your own country. And if you are in enclosed systems, I hate to tell you this, but the laws of entropy apply to enclosed systems. It will accelerate the rate of profits to decline. That becomes real. Because it can't be offset by leveraging time and different valuations and uneven development against each other. It accelerates a whole bunch of stuff, including the need to physically take over places to get raw inputs.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so you are more the neoliberals aren't wrong about this one thing. It does dramatically increase the likelihood of war with your neighbors.
Yeah. I don't know if you saw the new State Department plans, but it's basically to eliminate the whole State Department division as it deals with Africa, including eliminating diplomatic services in much of sub-Saharan Africa, which doesn't mean that the United States is completely abandoning Africa, but it means a different relationship. One might presume perhaps in places like Congo with large amounts of rare earth minerals and things of that sort, that it'd be a much more adversarial, but one much more based upon military means and adversarial relations and otherwise. And I think that's a response to, you know, not just the Chinese influence in Africa that's arisen, but also exactly this tendency that you're pointing to is like this in this new moment in time, like all of the airy notions of neoliberalism in the unipolar world settling back down to earth now, and actual material things allegedly becoming important again. You need to start allegedly thinking about warships off the coast of Congo to secure the resources before the Chinese get it. Similar to how we saw under COVID-19, I think it was the U.S. government commandeered a bunch of masks off the runway that were going to go to a European power. I think it was under Trump that we said, no, we have to commandeer those masks. Those are for us. And we take them off the runway, free trade be damned. These are the sorts of like horrifying, terrifying changes we're starting to see come down the pipe. But there is beginning maybe to be some logic to them that I think is might be understandable for people like you, people like me, listeners of this show, people who are attuned to these changes, as shitty as they are.
Well, I think some of them are, although I think we do have to quit. And I pick a thing from Adam to sane washing some of this, because I actually believe we've been sane washing liberals and we are really sane washing. Like I've seen people really stretch, like Yanis Varoufakis, really stretch to like justify that, like what Trump is doing makes some logical sense. Mm-hmm. And I think we all have to accept like the orientations do, but the particular policies actually don't.
Like, no, there's trying to understand a logic, and then there's sane washing like contingent political choices within that logic. I agree that the latter is foolish and crazy, you know, but I think that despite this, all behind all of this, there is some sort of historical, some inexorable logic that's working itself out, that will work itself out through conflict, internal conflict within itself, similar to like Trump and Biden both responding to sort of similar geopolitical and economic things in vastly different ways. Well, perhaps it'll be some synthesis of those two things that will logically arise out of this. We don't know. That's way different from saying like, well, actually Trump is playing 12D chess, or Doge is actually doing like the necessary cuts that you would need if you were going to implement the policies. No, I don't believe that. I think that these people are fundamentally misapprehend the economy, misapprehend world politics, because capitalism is like really good at producing misapprehensions about its own processes, as is history.
I'm going to say something that's going to make a lot of people uncomfortable. I don't think dialectical logic is actually good enough to get you through this. Because what you see now is there's so many different contradictions, and I'm putting that in finger quotes, that you are seeing the development of strange attractors, which is seeming chaos that eventually conforms into a pattern that does not, it isn't transcending. It is not some sublation of the two prior contradictions. It is literally like so many things are emerging at once. What is emergent from that is something completely fucking new. And I'm a dialectical thinker, but I do think there are limits to it. It's a very 19th century way of viewing the world. And I think that's why we get blindsided a lot, because we're like, oh, but there's this contradiction and this contradiction. I'm like, motherfucker, there's 40.
But you don't think, and maybe this is a good segue to going into the back half, the paywalled half of this, where you and I will talk about things that I don't want to put too fine a point on this, but might be like deportable offenses over the next 4 to 8 to 12 years. We will talk stuff like that, as we should, I think. But like, I feel confident that in 20 or 30 years, when you and I are still doing this mini series, I presume we're going to be doing it in 20 or 30 years. I don't know what's going to change in my life.
A mini series that lasts the majority of our life. But like, anyway.
Yeah. In 20 or 30 years, I feel confident that we'll be able to look back at this moment in time in retrospect, you know, after the owl has flown, and be able to tease out among these 40 contradictory processes, some sort of historical, some logic to it.
Right.
Now, we might all be sitting in some like fire-strewn hovel somewhere, like podcasts might not exist. Who knows? But I feel like I'll say two things. The idea that we as Marxists might have enough critical distance to be able to like dialectically unfurl this, or like to reason our way through it using some sort of like highfalutin process of logic, I don't believe that that's true. But also like the other thing too is that I don't think that's reason to give up.
No.
Right. I think it just means that it's reason to be humble, maybe.
I think we have to remember, I view Marxism as an unfinished project. And if one of you has a science, you kind of have to.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I remember the second thing I wanted to say. And this is like pretty important. It's something that I've been thinking about for a while, right? It's like all of us. And like, this is part of the ILC project. It's part of what you're trying to do in Utah. I think it's part of what we should all be doing right now. I think we need to recognize that, like, a lot of the disputes from the 19th and 20th century that we consider to be important, or importantly to be settled, right, don't really pertain to this anymore. Like, I don't think that there are, like, lessons that we can learn from the 1920s, 1930s, or even 1950s or 1960s that are going to help us as, like, revolutionaries try to figure stuff out. In fact, I think that that lack of humility, that this sense that, like, if we just fight out Kronstadt one last time, we'll get to the root of the matter and we'll be able to use this stuff moving forward, is an absolute fucking delusion. It's like the worst of what the left is right now, is imagining that, like, there's signposts and guideposts from our past and that we figured these problems out. We just need to figure out a way to, like, implement the correct leftist, Leninist, whatever policy solutions to the thing that we have to leave behind. That should be left behind in the 20th century. That is, like, what I'm imploring to the audience. Please, let's not imagine that we know anything more than we actually do, because we don't. Sorry. That was,
yeah, I actually would give China, I think Xi Jinping is actually a subtle and slightly right deviationist, frankly, Marxist-Leninist. But you know what he is actually doing? He is not totally relying on prior belief structures for what they're trying to do in China. And he's definitely not trying to uphold some sectarian line that's predetermined and doing that.
And they're weathering the storm, and Ezra Klein will eventually come around to Xi Jinping thought. That is my prediction on this, is that, like the last bastion of neoliberalism will be some sort of, like, China facing like post Bidenism.
Klein has done that in the past. Klein has actually flirted with Chinese thought. I mean, let's I'm going to use left wing here, knowing that I don't mean the left, whatever the fuck that is. I mean Democrats. But left wing neoliberalism has flirted with China as both a enemy and a model alternatingly, very rapidly, for the past 15, 20 years since Obama. Mm-hmm. Like, Obama both wanted to pivot to China as a rival, which changed geopolitics fundamentally. It actually was doing what Samuel Huntington, if you read The Collapse of Civilizations, everyone think that's about the war on terror, and it's one of the things about it. But you know what Samuel Huntington was really concerned with? It was not Islamic terrorism. It was China. Mm. And the other thing I would say, this is a thing that I think people think that the nation states are coming back. They're not. Nation states are strong enough to deal with this. But I think we are going to see civilizational blocks really come back. And I don't know if people are ready for that.
Yeah, I don't know if Americans are ready for it. American leftists are ready to line up behind their own civilizational block. Because if we're going to have various contenders, right, for global hegemony, if that's even possible anymore, right? Are you going to align with a Chinese model, a Russian model, some purportive, I guess, Muslim model? I'm trying to think of the civilizational blocks right here. Is it a valid thing to align with your own block? Is there something about, like, American or Anglo civilization that's alignable, or at least elements of it? That's going to be a really tough one when we're out of the unipolar moment, and, like, America's no longer really that great Satan that everybody's grown up having it. You know,
right, but the funny thing is, the left isn't going to be what did that. Like, decoupling was something China was prepared for, but it's clear that they didn't really want it yet. They were just willing to do it if we forced it.
Yeah. But they have been preparing. That's the important thing. Just right.
We haven't.
We haven't. Putin prepared for the Ukraine war and the sanctions regime that came, because, you know, other major powers have been anticipating this moment. But I agree, it's sped up in a way that maybe surprised them and all of us. There's a good opportunity, I feel like, to move to the paywalled section of things. We're really on a roll now, man. It might have been like 5-6 months, but we're back in the saddle, baby. Let's fucking go.
Right.
If you'd like to see this in video format, you'd like to see my hand waving right now, you'd like to see all the books that Derek Varn has in the background, become a patron at patreon.com/varnvlog and watch this video. Very cool. If you just want the audio and the bonus content from the Antifada, patreon.com/theantifada, sign up and do it. A quick note I would say is that the Independent Labor Club of New York City is having a on May Day, a traditional event, chili cook-off. We won't be marching in the streets with red and black flags this year. Maybe you'll find people to do that with, but we are going to have a competitive chili cook-off at Woodbine Space. So make space for that in your calendar, May 1st, May Day, ILC chili cook-off. We'll see you New York City folks there. Farin, yeah. What do you want to say before we close out?
Organized Utah will be doing something similar. I don't think it's a chili cook-off, but it is, and it does involve more tabling, but I don't think we involve rallies or marches. There's going to be games and stuff like that.
Hell yeah.
So look up Utah UT for that. It's similar to the independent labor clubs. We're not a competitor, although we do more traditional coordinating and organizing, I think, than you guys do.
Let 100 flowers bloom, I say.
Right. So upcoming, all kinds of stuff, including why Zoomers are so fucking hard to predict. actual materialism, stuff we can't talk about in public.
Yeah. Why it might be, I don't know. Uh-oh. We pause for a second. We'll see you on the other side.